have the opportunity to see you today, and I've enjoyed being at Sunstone again this year. 17 years ago, I was a very young sophomore at BYU, very young, very innocent, very naive, and I was anxiously awaiting my mission call, which I got and accepted a call to serve in Seoul, Korea. My text for our discussion today is a scripture from that time. My favorite missionary, not companion, but who lived in the same house with me in my favorite area, Elder Guthrie, was this very dry, witty fellow who would memorize and would like to recite Alma 17, verse 23 in a very, very serious tone of voice, which is, and the scripture is, "And Alma said to King Lamoni, 'Yea, I desire to dwell among this people for a time, yea, and perhaps until the day I die.'" And so we tell this to everyone in Korea, in English or in Korean, as an opportunity presented itself. However, after a couple of years, it turns out that we did not stay in Korea until we died. And instead, I returned to the Pacific Northwest, which is home, and to BYU, and to the real world. 10 years later, which was 5 years ago, I was an attorney with a big law firm in Seattle, and I was dissatisfied and frustrated with my job working in commercial litigation. And I applied for and accepted a job with the ACLU in Chicago. I had never been to Chicago other than O'Hare Airport's United Terminal until I had this job interview. So this was a huge leap. But I was excited about it, and so I packed everything into my very dented little red car and drove across the country to Chicago, where I spent the next 5 years. This last Christmas, I decided, for a lot of reasons, some of which I don't understand myself yet, that it was time to go home, and so I'm moving back to Seattle, leaving the practice of law with the ACLU, and I told my parents and my employers that I was going to be leaving in 6 months. And so I just, a month ago, finally finished, and I've wrapped up this. And over the course of the last 6 months, I had a lot of opportunity to finish the projects I was working on, to think about the experience of being a civil rights lawyer and an ACLU lawyer. And I increasingly recognize parallels with the way that I was responding to leaving the ACLU as I had 15 years before leaving Korea, that so many of my experiences as a full-time civil rights lawyer were very parallel to my experiences as a full-time missionary, and the way that I responded to the situations was often following similar patterns and using similar baggage and similar tools. And to be completely honest, actually, the reason I'm doing this paper is because my therapist in Chicago she's one of those people that doesn't ever actually flat out say anything. It's always like, "Well, and how do you feel about that?" But like 3 months ago, she like flat out said, "You know, this whole ACLU thing has been a mission for you." And the fact, she actually had expressed an opinion about something. So it got me thinking and organizing my thoughts. And so what I wanted to do for the next 20 minutes is to share some of the parallels that I found in looking back both at my mission in Korea and my mission in Chicago, to identify some of the recurring themes, and then hopefully at the end to draw some conclusions about that. And as I was sitting in my handy dandy, now that I don't have a computer anymore, notebook, writing things, I saw different clusters of issues. The first thing I wanted to share is the idea of having a vocation. I've had jobs before. I was a lawyer. I would sue people. But I found that being a civil rights lawyer was something that I felt that it was a consuming thing. This is something that I felt was the time and the place for me. And what I was doing was important. It was something that I had mission to do, just like I did when I was in Korea. And I went about it in very similar ways. I can see waiting for the mission call in the dorms in Provo, knowing that my whole life is going to be affected by this mysterious piece of paper, which is set into place by forces and people beyond me, but that would be for me, and it would be and was the call that would change my life. And similarly, I knew I wanted to go do this kind of activism, but I had no idea where I was going to be, whether it was going to be Los Angeles or New York or Chicago or something. And I went into this with the same feeling of control and lack of control, of destiny and choice in the same sort of way, and the feeling that this was a calling. The second thing in this idea of a vocation as compared to a normal job, and being a missionary or being an ACLU lawyer is not a normal job, is the idea of being a full-time professional, where you are there 24/7, that your job is to represent, to be an ambassador. As a missionary, I mean, those of us here who've had that experience, that really is something that's drilled into you in the MTC, and that I certainly felt that there was this immense responsibility, that this wasn't just something that you're punching a clock over, that you were there and you were to be consumed by this, that this was something you couldn't put aside. Similarly, I found that about my job in Chicago. As you're my actual job title as a staff attorney was the director of the Lesbian Gay Rights Project, which meant that I was dealing with discrimination. But it meant that I was also very much part of a community where I would go to events and I would represent the ACLU, and it was something where you didn't get to stop. I remember that one of the biggest things that I found as a ACLU was that it made going to parties no fun anymore, because you had to suck up to people all the time, and so I would go to a reception like twice a week. There'd be some kind of wine and cheese like foofy reception that in some random hotel ballroom, something like this, and it was my job to go where the little pillow my name is. And you really felt that you'd walk in, you'd scan the crowd, you'd identify the person with the money, you'd identify the congressman that you had to go lobby, and you just could not have any fun. You were just it was just like a job. And similarly, I felt that way as a missionary, perhaps like most missionaries, not always and not enough. But you really did feel like that even in your P-Day clothes, you were always there was really a party. You never got a chance to get away from it. And you always would hear these horror stories about the one time the missionary snuck out and someone from the ward sees them and it's terrible. Or you climb the Buddha and the church is kicked out of this country for 10 years. I mean, part of this is an urban myth, but that's partly a big part of how we approached our experience was that. And I really felt that. And like the Buddha story, I hadn't thought about that, but even though my primary job was doing the lesbian gay rights stuff, because I was the youngest of the senior lawyers, I became the internet lawyer because I had a computer and everyone else was 15 years older, and so sort of by default I became an expert in computer privacy and the internet and just this random thing. And so I would go to a few months ago I was speaking at the National Convention of Heads of insurance company law departments talking about privacy of electronic medical records. But I remember the first time I had one of these speaking gigs after I'd been at the ACLU in Chicago for 6 months or a year, where we were invited to give testimony on a proposal for computerized court records. And it was an interesting feeling to sit down and there was some boring person talking about cost and that, and I would sit down, and I'd say I was from the ACLU, and all of a sudden, these judges and these senior people were peppering me with questions about the First Amendment, and I was thinking, that it's like, this 80-year-old organization, I'm going to sell us out by accident because I don't know about this stuff. I'm making this up. But there really was this feeling that this was a very core, fundamental issue where when the ACLU took a position on the First Amendment, it was something that was significant, and here I was like, I didn't know what I was talking about. I really felt that as I reacted to that, the way that I did as a missionary, where you really felt like you had that responsibility, and even though you were just a 19-year-old young man, that you really did have this feeling that if you got it wrong, then President Kimball in that era would somehow be shamed by your statement, and some horrible thing would happen. On a similar note, one of the experiences of the LDS church experience is having a lay ministry. And I think that's immensely important, and I think that's something that is a valuable experience for us in the Mormon world, but as the way we approach things. The idea that everyone participates, in contrast to other religions where it's only for the professionals. I mean, sometimes it would be nice to have someone with a little professional counseling experience come in and be the bishop, but all things considered, it's actually a pretty good deal. And I saw that in my role as a professional activist, that I would work with volunteers. And the way being a missionary is for 2 years being a professional clerical person, an unusual position for a Mormon, and not a normal one, and not a natural fit. Just like being a paid progressive activist rather than a grassroots volunteer is very different. And I'm actually looking forward to the experience of just being an amateur and getting to do it on the side instead of my calling being my job. Finally, a part of the vocation that I felt that was a parallel with my mission experience and my lawyer experience is the idea of being in this project together. My favorite experiences, or my favorite growing experience as a missionary, was with the group of elders that I started in Korea with. And we would get together every once in a while, and there really was this sense of a St. Crispin's Day band, the speech from King Henry V, the play, about the idea of men who hear of your deeds today will think themselves unfortunate not to have been there. The idea of being part of that 30,000 people in my day, 50,000 people now, and being part of a shared enterprise, it was so important. And so I felt some of that. The best professional experiences I have had as an activist were those kind of communal things where you really were working together and bringing that together. And I saw that the way that I reacted to those was resonated with recollections of what it was like to be part of this band from the MTC going out to face Korea and Korea. The second cluster of parallels that I found as I was looking back was recognizing that being a missionary is really, really hard. And it's something we don't often admit. And similarly, being an ACLU lawyer is often very hard. I've got on talk radio shows where I got like 20 screaming phone callers saying very mean things about me. And I joke about it. But I think that it's something that we don't always admit to ourselves, or when we come back from our missions, to talk about some of the challenges and how profoundly hard and rewarding, yes, but still difficult it can be. In particular, actually, the one parallel I would share is I am fundamentally very bad at and dislike sales and marketing. So being a missionary was excruciating painful. The hardest thing in the world for me is to try and sell something. And so here I was, forced to do something that just went against my grain. And similarly, as a lawyer, I actually hate conflict. Being a lawyer was just a terrible, terrible mistake. I don't know what I was thinking. I didn't want to finish my master's thesis, so I went to law school. And I ended up in this thing. And I look back after 5 years of 10 years as a lawyer and 5 years as a civil rights lawyer, it was really, you know, I just hate going to court. I hate picking up the phone and screaming at opposing counsel. And I was interested in thinking of that, about how I reacted to that. As a missionary, I sort of like schemed my way into minimizing the actual hours of tracting. I actually, because my background is in language, I spent 3 months of my mission writing language textbooks for Korean missionaries. And so I would sort of like figure out ways to do something valuable that wasn't this horrible thing I hate to do. And similarly, as a civil rights lawyer, yes, I would go to court and I would do that, but I also would look for ways that I felt that I could avoid this thing that was so hard for me and yet was really what I was supposed to be paid to be doing. Finally, the other hardship for me of in both was being in exile. I loved Korea and Koreans, but I was immensely homesick for the Pacific Northwest and for my family. And similarly, I love Chicago, and I, as with Elder Guthrie's scripture, I thought perhaps I would put down roots there and stay there and continue this. My colleagues have been there forever, but at the end, I really felt it was time to be closer to my family. It was time to do something else, and I found that to be a parallel of wanting to be home. The final cluster of themes that I think brought together my missionary experiences in Korea and in Chicago was how much time was something that dominated my life. How, in several ways, as a missionary, the cycle of the year is really magnified. So you have your weeks that everything looks to P-Day. You have your months that everything looks to the transfer. You have the months that everything looks to getting rid of that companion you can't stand anymore. Or you have zone conference. There really is in sort of like other religions have a liturgical calendar which goes from Advent to Christmas to Epiphany. The Mormon Church doesn't have that, but a mission in some ways gives you that experience where you really do have that calendar. And similarly, my experience in 5 years of running this project was that it's March, it must be this particular black tie thing, the legislative session would be part of it, and you really did have this very natural rhythm that perhaps is my ancestral farming genes coming out of the idea that the seasons really do matter. And being a missionary, you really are a person who's affected by the seasons and the year and the week and the month. And in particular, two things. One is the great offering you make, the sacrifice, the gift you give is your time. Being a mission is giving 2 years of your life. And similarly, being a full-time activist is saying, I'm going to devote myself to this cause and give my time. I don't have much money, don't have these other things. And so that is in the ultimate sacrifice. And finally, I was a very trunky missionary. I was ready to come home when I was ready to come. And like all missionaries, you because it has an ending point, your mission becomes this art. And no matter how gracefully you do it, it comes to the end. And similarly, I saw that as I was leaving as I was leaving Chicago, where I decided in December I would be leaving in June. I had things to wrap up. And I was pretty good, like a missionary, until like very close to the end. But by the last month, I was not the most productive person in the world. And I see that as any kind of mission, that you do have that natural flow of the seasons, including the end, just as in life, as in season. I got very trunky. I just have to admit it. But I was productive, just like a missionary. I was productive, but trunky. So I had to teach people in Chicago what the word trunky meant, since they didn't know. So. Having shared these parallels and things, let me step back and close with a couple of a global thoughts that I had about the experience of the enterprise of making these comparisons. One is to look at life and see how easy it is to get to see these parallels. I'm a person of parallels, and I see sometimes that I find myself falling into the same patterns, sometimes in a healthy way and sometimes in an unhealthy way. My therapist at one point did accuse me of having repetition compulsion, which they throw these jargony things around. And it is true that I did date like 4 emotionally unavailable 24-year-olds in a row, and that's not going to happen again. But you do see yourself approaching these things. And I think about the experience of coping with trunkiness or the experience of dealing with being a full-time professional and seeing sometimes you make the same mistakes or you respond to things in the same rhythm. Sometimes it can be a negative thing. You sort of like feel like you're in a Kafka novel where you're going to date the same 24-year-old over and over and over, and you're going to knock on that same door in Korea over and over and over. But I also think that it's a positive thing in the way that the mission experience is such a profound archetypal Mormon experience, particularly for Mormon men, that it is not surprising that I would approach other life experience using those archetypes and seeing myself in these rhythms, whether as an individual or as a group, we share these kinds of themes. I recognize that many of my life experiences far away from Utah and far away from Korea are things that come back and resonate with the same stories, the same fundamental texts, whether they're scriptural stories or family stories or personal experiences, where those memories and those experiences repeat and build on each other and resonate. And finally, I would close by saying that I found, for me at least, that the real parallel between being a Mormon missionary and being spending 5 years as a civil rights full-time lawyer, there's a sort of a truism in the church that we talk about, not often in front of the youth, that the real purpose of a mission is not to go out there and convert converts. It's actually not a very efficient way to do it. We could spend that same amount of money and hire professionals or a media campaign or something else. If our goal were to have 137,000 convert baptisms a year, the last thing we would do is take a bunch of 50,000 19-year-old kids from Idaho and send them to Korea. You can't say this to kids in the MTC or to high schools, but the truth is, missions are not about converting about changing the converts. It's about changing the missionaries. It is an experience that is part of being a Mormon. It's part of growing up, particularly for 19-year-old young men who need to grow up. And it is paradoxical because, as the scripture says, it is only in losing your life that you save it. If you went on your mission and said, I'm going out there to learn a skill so I can come back and sell Amway, you would be a bad missionary and you wouldn't learn what you need to learn. It is only by losing yourself in this kind of service that you can really grow up in the way that missionaries and young men really need to do. And I really, after 5 years in Chicago, I would have to say the same thing about my experience there, that I had immense successes and immense failures and wonderful experiences, but my greatest accomplishment was to grow up, and even though I'm a little older and have less hair and more wrinkles than I did 5 years ago and certainly than I did 17 years ago as a missionary, I am very happy for the growth that I made by having the chance to serve in a new way, even though, as I said, I did it in some old and some new ways. But that was the ultimate parallel for me, that service is something that is so profoundly transformative that no matter what you're doing, if you're embarked on a cause, you will be changed if you do lose yourself in it. And so I will close, as I did when I left Korea and as I did when I left the ACLU at my final farewell banquet in May, by saying, Kachi Pongsa Hanan Kiwil, Pa'araso, Tanani Kamsa Hamida, Nanan Kohangi Kanande, Ani Keshiil Paramida, which in Korean is, I'm immensely grateful for the opportunity to serve, and as I go home, I wish you all peace. Thank you.
While I was working on this, it turned out to be more of what I call a performance piece than a talk. So we shall see. You see them all the time, in town, on campus, biking up and down the street. It's not hard to pick them out. Their white shirts, their dark shoes, their old man pants, a kind of goofy earnestness. And those black name tags. Lots of times you stop and talk to them. Where are you from? They're surprised when you know their hometowns. Knew someone from there once. Dated his sister. You also see them in your home. They come to see Diana, your wife Diana, who's bedbound with multiple sclerosis, but she's always cheerful and welcoming. They like to talk to her. She's really interested. And she knows their hometowns better than you do. Some of them have heard about you, this guy who writes strange things about the Mormons. They maybe want to see something. And sometimes you'll show them the Mormon mystery novels you published before you realized you weren't Raymond Chandler. And photos of your play you did with Hollywood actors. And sometimes you'll show them the poster of the movie you wrote, the one with Charlton Heston as Brigham Young, a Mormon public affairs primal fantasy. You note how young they are, the missionaries. Lots of them still in their teens, ill-informed, naive, not really ready for dialogue with thinking people. But then you were young and ill-informed and naive, and not much of a thinker. You were from Kaysville, for goodness sake, this rural farm community with maybe 2,000 souls, farmers, merchants, guys who work at Hillfield, a few cowboys. You've been thinking a lot about your mission lately, 2 years in Great Britain when it was all one mission. You've dragged out boxes of memorabilia, pictures, letters, other things. You've reread your mission journal. You've always known your mission was this crucial rite of passage, this rite of passage for you. But lately you've been thinking how much you saw the mission change in those 2 years, the church. You're thinking that maybe you saw the future. Now, you know Mormons, missions are different than they were 40 years ago. Of course they are. Nothing ever stays the same, and you sure understand why. In 1957, when you left on your mission, the church was straining to reach a couple million. It's now 12 million and growing. Maybe half people of color. Damn impressive. Who could quarrel with that? But some things get lost, certain functions, a routine, an approach to people, an ethic. Of course, as your playwright friend writes, you got to give up some to get some. Tuesday, May 21st, 1957, your first night in London, and already you meet two impressive people. Mission President Clifton G. M. Kerr and Millennial Star editor Richard L. Evans, Jr., then a young missionary. The mission headquarters are in this old Victorian mansion on Nightingale Lane in Balham, London. Partly you figure because it's cheaper, there weren't all those big bucks for buildings yet, but maybe out of some urge to blend in with the local culture. You have an image of President Kerr as this really able and really nice gentleman farmer from Tremonton. He welcomes you warmly and tells you he's sure you'll be a fine missionary, and then he tells you to soak up as much of the culture as you can. Go to plays and concerts, mix in with the local people, and he also tells you in his mission you don't have to wear hats. Wow. Then that very night, you're whisked off to Hyde Park Speaker's Corner with a half dozen other greenhorns, and you're pushed up there on this box, and you babble out something, and it's just a totally terrifying experience. And the next day, you're on a train north of Nottingham, and there you meet your first district president, and it's Elder Rolf Kerr, the mission president's son. And you meet your first senior companion, Elder Delbert Stewart. Hello, I'm Elder Stewart, and this is Elder Stewart. Any questions? Now, you have to know something of the current regimen in the Missionary Training Center in Provo. The weeks in residence, isolation from your loved ones, intense preparation, an assigned companion like you're already on your mission. Now, you know it isn't anything like that in 1957. Back then, it's pretty casual. All you get's this loosely supervised week at the Salt Lake Mission Home. There are some hit-or-miss lessons on gospel principles, or maybe how to teach them, and a few gentle suggestions on how you should behave in the mission field. And you listen to inspiring talks. You especially remember this distinguished guy named Lynn McKinley, who had this impressive head of hair and a wonderful voice, and he gets you choked up, just like an old movie actor. And you think one of the talks is by Marion D. Hanks. And, of course, there's the mission home head, President Richards. You even have the option of going home at night. If you live close enough, you go home almost every night. In fact, you're gone part of pretty much every day. The fact is, you have this major problem to solve before you get on that train. Now, most of you have to know, 20-year-old males can't go 5 minutes without thinking about girls. Well, most males. And it can't be a secret that things don't really change when you're on your mission. For most of you, there are girls everywhere, in the letters you write, in the letters you get, in your little tracting chats about whether it's okay to take off your garments when you have sex. Girls in pretty much every corner of your mind. It's a really remarkable idea, you know, a right mix of unalloyed genius and formalized sadism. Here's your church sending its young men out in their prime mating years at the height of their sexual ardor, sending them off for 2 years with a charge to be celibate. You go through that, you can go through anything. So in order to talk honestly about your mission, you have to talk about girls. Now, you've planned to leave on your mission after spring quarter at BYU. You're well into the term, you're cast in a play, you're studying hard, and you're seriously dating this girl. Call her Dorothy. And you're just crazy about her. Now, Dorothy's 2 or 3 years older than you, and she's just spent 2 years at this top-end English or Eastern college. Dorothy is very smart, and she thinks you're very smart. You're in plays together, you study together, you read Cahill Gibran together, and you're falling in love. Well, it's late March, and you're both getting serious, and Dorothy all of a sudden feels this urge to be completely honest with you. You see, Dorothy hasn't learned what most good Mormon girls learn by the time they're 12. You don't tell a prospective husband anything he doesn't absolutely need to know. Like you really don't want to have children, like your father's a serial pedophile, like you really hate Palmolive aftershave. Those are things prospective husbands need to know. But you certainly don't tell them about old boyfriends. So it's a Wednesday, and you and Dorothy are driving to Salt Lake to rehearse some dramatic spectacle in the tabernacle, and she tells you what you don't need to know on Highway 91 somewhere between Orem and American Fork. And what she tells you is she lived with this guy her last year at this high-tone Eastern college. Lived with a guy. Now, this is 1957, and you've never even touched a girl improperly, and Dorothy's lived with a guy. Well, you know the manly thing to do. You know God tells you to forgive people, and you know Dorothy sincerely repented, but you're shattered. Your little adolescent life's all of a sudden in pieces. So what do you do? Well, the first thing you do is run back and start courting your old high school sweetheart. Call her Donna Kay. You started dating Donna Kay when she was 12, and you know she won't even French kiss. The one problem is that last year Donna Kay dumped you. Dumps you while you're away for your first year at BYU. This is hard on you. But after a few weeks in your basement with Elvis and Johnny Ray, you get over it. But here you are, back on her doorstep again, for her beauty and personality, certainly, but mostly because she doesn't French kiss. And the second thing you do after launching off after Donna Kay is you quit school, and you ask them to send you on your mission as fast as they can. You run like hell from the problem. Now this week you're in the mission home, you're a mess. You're dating both girls, you're putting hundreds of miles on your dad's 55 Studebaker, you're still wanting to forgive Dorothy, you're hoping Donna Kay will fall in love with you again. Your mother thinks you're going nuts, you're missing in action at the mission home. President Richards says he doubts you'll ever get out of Utah. The one happening that does lift you out of your emotional tornado is the day you receive your endowments in the Salt Lake Temple. It's one of the truly amazing experiences of your life, from the intimate washings and anointings through the ritual donning of your sacred garments, the holy and symbolic journey ever upward from room to room, the creation room, the Eden room, the world room, the terrestrial room, and the awesome celestial room. And you're impressed by those marvelous old people who aren't actors but who play sacred beings. The next time you feel such peace is deep Monday night before you leave. You're rushed awake at 3 a.m. by this amazing feeling. You're carried out of your bed, out of the house, out to the front lawn, and there's this wondrous spectacle going on. A full moon pushing light through scattered clouds, stars dancing all over the sky, the Great Salt Lake bright with moonlight, Antelope Island alive as this great comforting water creature. You know you're having a revelation. The Lord is talking to you, and what he's saying is it's all right to let Dorothy go. And he promises you can have Donna Kay. And you'll go on your mission, and everything will be just fine. In the next few days, you break up with Dorothy, and Donna Kay falls in love with you again, and you're set apart for your mission by Apostle Hugh B. Brown, and your mother's relieved, and President Richards begins to think you'll maybe make it past Omaha. And so with loved ones waving goodbye on the platform, you board the Union Pacific train that'll take you to New York and the Queen Elizabeth that'll take you to Portsmouth. You have vivid memories of those first months, the rooms you inhabit, the streets you track, the boroughs you cross and recross, tight-packed neighborhoods of middle-class row houses, walking and cycling all those Nottingham Hills. You and Elder Stewart take room and board in a small row house in Mapperley on the edge of Nottingham. Your landlady, Mrs. Aldridge, is this rugged English woman who seems always to be wearing a bloody apron. She heats the water for your baths once a week on Saturday, and she cooks you three full meals a day, big meals, and she sets out snacks for you when you end the day, big snacks, all solid, starchy English food. You buy things at small shops, your first taste of white chocolate, and the smells. The smells linger yet. You ride green double-decker buses, number 55, to and from the square at the center of town where they hold their street meetings. It's a short hop on another green bus to district headquarters and branch meetings, an old house the other side of town. You always have vivid sense memories of times you were in pain. And the first 3 months of your mission are perhaps day by day the worst months of your life. You hate getting up early, you hate the regimen, you hate all those hills you have to walk or cycle, you hate feeling ignorant and stupid, you hate getting up in the city square and preaching every other day, and you hate your first companion. You're sure Elder Stewart's been given a special calling by somebody high in the church to make your life a living hell. But you have escapes. You're saved by frequent excursions to the Flicks, long double features with lots of advertisements, by shows at the Nottingham Playhouse, by writing endlessly in your journal all sorts of painful adolescent anguish. You also become obsessed with mealtime. In 3 months, you gain 40 pounds, and you're a regular at the local tailor. He keeps letting your pants out. And there are, of course, the letters from Donna Kay, faithful Donna Kay, who won't even French kiss. And you're also saved in those early tough months by a motivator that's pretty much new in your life. You taste the special pleasure of personal ambition. But more about that later. Your early months of trial finally end when, after a suitable testing time, Elder Kerr takes Elder Stewart out of your life, and he assigns you Elder Donald Chisholm, one of the nicest and gentlest men you'll ever know. And the day-to-day labor begins to do its work on you. You begin to enjoy the subtle pleasures of tracting. The little thrill when somebody invites you in and lets you tell them about Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon. The promise when you start down a new street. The special mission speak you elders create as you tract. Chances to daydream together, to imagine your lives. And, of course, to share your fantasies about those faithful virgins waiting back home. And you get to enjoy the meetings with investigators, working to figure them out, adjusting your teaching approach to their needs. And you have time to do that in 1957. The British Mission Lesson Plan consists of 18 lessons. And you're not to baptize a soul until they've had the full course. Time to deal with idiosyncratic byways of Mormon ethics and theology, the stuff that makes it fun. Sometimes you carry investigators more than a year. A smart Catholic gentleman named Mr. Scott has been inviting missionaries into his home for maybe 3 years, swearing always that just next week he'll stop smoking and start paying tithing. When he learns you're a theater guy, he takes a day and drives you to Stratford. He never joins the church, of course, but he's interesting and generous and always inscribed in your mind. Another thing you begin to enjoy are the street meetings. You find you fill 15 minutes just fine, and once you even do an hour straight. And there are usually 100 or so people there, maybe 500 pigeons. Probably the thing you get to like best about the street meetings are the hecklers. There's this steady rotation of 3 or 4 or 5 older gentlemen who know Mormon history and scripture better than you do. And they work hard to top each other with impossible questions. Do you fellows really believe Jesus had 3 wives? How could Joseph Smith read those gold plates when they weren't even in the room? Why did he marry other people's wives? Stuff like that. And the inevitable and impossible, why don't Mormons allow Negroes to be priests? You learn to be a pretty good sophist, not a bad debater. Great for personal growth, street meetings, but they never give you any converts. One of the special pleasures of the British Mission in the late 50s are the extraordinary people you meet. There's Rolf Kerr, who's later Utah's Commissioner of Education and who's remarkable even then, and Stephen Covey, who's district president in Ireland and who's no doubt already thinking up his 7 habits of highly effective people. And every few months you get a visit to the mission by the mission president's second counselor. The second counselor is an elder chosen from among the 2-year missionaries. His main duty is to inspire you in the trenches missionaries. The second counselors you knew were Edwin Firmage, Alan Brown, and Carlisle Hunsicker. You're impressed by them all. And this should get you back to the ambition thing, the missionary pecking order. Now, all of you who taste this ambition thing know getting to be second counselor has a lot to do with timing, even if you're wonderful. But there are many lesser glories, and on some primal level, you become very competitive. The first step on your ladder of success is to become a senior companion. You take 7 months to do that. But your first official administrative assignment comes after 6, and in mid-November, you're called to be branch president in the little town of Hucknall, Nottinghamshire. Not bad, you think to yourself, but not all that good either, you discover. Most of the saints there have been in the church for a long time, and they're very old, and they need a young missionary to lead them because they absolutely can't tolerate each other. You devote long hours to refereeing petty disputes, stuff growing out of old and deep personality clashes and resentments. You have to moderate Sunday school arguments about whether shrubs and trees and cats and cockroaches have spirits, or whether the sun is really a celestial orb inhabited by colonies of resurrected polygamous beings who can translate instantly to Kolob, the throne of God. After a time, though, you get actually to enjoy it, find you're pretty good at managing things. After the first of the year, you get your first junior companion, and you move your field of labor from Hucknall to a string of grubby little coal mining towns a bus ride away. Derbyshire towns that are all run together, towns that consist of mile after mile of shabby row houses surrounded by enormous slag heaps and heavy old machinery and these scarce spots of grayed-out grass, towns constantly under black clouds of burning coal. And you can't wash the smell out of your clothes or the grime out of your skin. The drab little towns of Heener and Langley Mill and Loscoe Grange and Eastwood. And you spend the next 4 months tracting up and down the sooty black hills of these towns, knocking on door after door. One morning, you're startled to come upon a small brass plaque on one of those dingy little row houses. It reads, Birthplace of D.H. Lawrence. But it's in those little towns that you grow genuinely to like what you're doing on an hour-by-hour basis. The joy of finding and teaching people seriously interested in the gospel, people who become friends and join the church, people whose lives you actually help change. There's Derek Spriggs, who lives with his parents and works in the mines, down pit. Derek takes to you and your message the first visit. Within 2 weeks, he's coming to church and paying tithing. You baptize him, and he later serves a mission in England. And then he emigrates to Utah, and he educates himself. And last you hear, he's Assistant Director of the Office of High School and College Relations at BYU. And in an adjoining town, there are the Plums, a family of three who embrace you in the gospel and join the church. And when you visit them in 1981, the family's enlarged and everybody but Dad is active in the church. And you arrive just in time to help them celebrate their youngest daughter's 18th birthday. You've apparently become a family legend, and to everyone's delight, you just drop out of the sky for this special occasion. You and Elder Parker still bus into Nottingham for street meetings, and you still go to a lot of movies. But you see your first production of Waiting for Godot at the Nottingham Playhouse, and you keep writing in your journal for a while. But it's sporadic, and then you're too busy. And you stop eating like a lumberjack and start to drop those extra pounds, more visits to the tailor. And Donna Kay, sweet Donna Kay, you discover that what the Lord really promised was that Donna Kay would be faithful as long as you needed her. And after 7 months, she does what you've pretty much come to expect, and she sends you your Dear John letter. So Donna Kay drops out of school her freshman year, marries this returned missionary, and settles in to be a stay-at-home mom. When you last hear, she's on the general primary board. Not a good match, you and she. At the end of April, you're called to be a missionary in Cambridge in the Norwich district. And what a change. Cambridge. All those grand old buildings, all those bicycles and long black gowns and smart faces. In the day's tracting, you have little debates with Cambridge students and colloquy with Arab Muslims, Indian Hindus, Ethiopian Jews. And you spend one fascinating evening with a congregation of Baha'is who love the Joseph Smith story. And they embrace him alongside dozens of other visionaries. Are they trying to undermine your faith in God's one true church? And you see strange and disturbing new plays at the university, plays like you've never seen before. And you get your first taste of serious films, The Red Shoes, Ulysses, A King in New York. It's late June when your summons to leadership comes. You're called to be district president of the Norwich District with headquarters in Ipswich. Now, the difference between district presidents and supervising elders is that district presidents not only preside over the missionaries in the area, 10 of them in Norwich, but also over the branches of local members, in this case some 600 saints. A few of the districts in the mission have local leadership, but most are still presided over by 20-some-year-old missionaries from the American West. You replace Elder Larry Wimmer, who goes on to become an economics professor at BYU, another impressive guy. Before you begin your tenure as district leader, President Kerr calls a conference in early July at the Mission Home, now in an imposing old townhouse in Kensington. He invites all the supervising elders and district presidents, both local and missionary. As you look at the group picture, you see President Kerr and Alan Brown and Carlisle Hunsaker, and you see Terry Warner. Terry's now editor of the Millennial Star, and he becomes a good friend in London and later at BYU. And in the back row of that picture, where they put the tall guys, there you are beside Elder Chisholm, who's now supervising elder in Wales. And just to the left is Merrill Bateman, who's later president of BYU. The conference is a heady and glorious three-day affair where you have lessons and inspirational talks and get to meet your equivalents all through the mission. One late afternoon, you all descend on Hyde Park Speaker's Corner, and you're comfortable amidst all the religious and political wackos who make this a way of life. And you're handsomely entertained in the evenings. You all take in the Royal Ballet at Covent Garden, and you've treated to dinner at a high-toned Hungarian restaurant by this wealthy district president from Manchester. Now, presiding over 10 missionaries in the district proves to be quite all right. When you travel, you rent a car, usually a Morris Minor. The missionaries are a good lot, and there doesn't seem to be a really screwed-up branch in the district. In fact, many of the branches are an interesting mix of native English saints, American Air Force personnel, and in Cambridge, some strong professional people. The real problem comes up in Ipswich, right under your nose, where you find yourself facing stuff way beyond your experience. In the scariest case, a young Air Force enlistee's wife with three kids comes to beg your help. It seems her husband is having an affair with this smashing young sister whose husband's in the Middle East doing business for British Petroleum. What to do? Here you're this 21-year-old kid who's never even French kissed being faced with maybe terminal adultery. You've got to do something. So following little more than a gut instinct, you take the woman and her five children you hide them with some local saints. Well, this seems to wake up her husband, who quickly becomes frantic, drops his girlfriend, and starts begging you to tell him where his family is. 6 months later, you get a thank you letter signed by both the husband and wife, you figure you lucked out. You were in way over your head. In mid-July, you're assigned a new junior companion, Elder John T. Evans. Elder Evans' father is Richard L. Evans, prominent apostle and weekly voice of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Now, by this time, you've figured out that Great Britain is considered a highly prestigious mission. Hey, Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff, Parley P. Pratt all served here. Longest-running magazine is published here. It's no accident you're meeting all these amazing young men. But the church seems to feel the need to leaven the population with a few common folk, like Elder Leroy Matthews from Virgin, Utah, or Elder Robert Puffer from Beaver, Utah, or Elder Yu from Kaysville, Utah. You just, by gosh, lucked out. You hardly hang out with Mormon royalty. You didn't even hang out with the popular guys in high school. So while you're honored to be chosen to help break Elder Evans in, you're also intimidated. And here's this suave patrician prince of the church, and you selected to tend him. So you're relieved it goes all right. You get on well, enjoy several months together. You like hearing how he can listen to his father's sermons on CBS and figure out what's gone on in the family last week. And you're fascinated when he tells you his Uncle Joe is a really fun guy. Now, Uncle Joe to you is Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith. And to you, he's this really dour man who's this totally obstinate biblical literalist who's just published a book telling you the world's not quite 6,000 years old and the dinosaurs sprang up like 4,000 years ago when Satan set loose this malignant spirit in the world. But you have no reason to doubt that on a personal level, Uncle Joe is a very nice person. One of the later major events of your mission, one of the major events in British mission history, is the dedication of the London Temple in September 1958. The Swiss and London temples are a clear indication that the church now expects its members to stay where they are rather than immigrate to Zion. One of the first steps in making Mormonism a truly world religion, and what an event it is. It brings the prime leadership of the church to England, especially President and Prophet David O. McKay. This tall, attractive, white-haired man who really looks like a prophet. It also brings missionaries and other saints from all over Europe. There are several dedication sessions in the temple so everyone can participate. Your parents even show up. But in the midst of this celebration of the future, an unsettling reminder of Mormonism's past hangs over the goings-on. It only comes to you through the missionary grapevine, and you have to piece rumor together with what you're seeing. It seems that the charismatic second counselor of the French mission president has been surreptitiously preaching Mormon fundamentalism, preaching polygamy to his fellow missionaries, declaring himself to be a prophet, and being second counselor, he has a lot of contact with those missionaries. He's already made converts. You watch the French missionaries. You watch them come and go to interviews with high church officials. You know them because they wear hats. And they won't talk to you. They've clearly been told not to talk to anybody. The last thing church leaders want is lurid tales of current polygamous Mormons in the notorious British tabloids. As you look back, you realize this has to be a major factor in the church's standardizing missions and tightening the rules. Things would never be as loose and idiosyncratic as you found them. There is something else that troubles you in the midst of this dedication celebration. The inside of the temple is different. Most of the temple ceremony is now on film. The only actual movement you make is from the washings and anointings to the main auditorium, where the film is shown. And then there's from there through the veil to the celestial room. Not a real journey there anymore. At first, this whole new thing is kind of exhilarating, something fresh, something different. But then you think about the actual ascending moment from room to room, the wonderful old people who didn't pretend to be actors, who reflected the earthly simplicity of it all. In fact, you know some of the film actors, perhaps people from BYU, like Lynn McKinley, who looks and sounds like a movie star. And then he arrives, T. Bowring Woodbury, the new president of the British mission. In October 1958, President Woodbury takes over and immediately announces a new era in the British mission. T. Bowring Woodbury is unique in your experience of church leaders. The brethren are normally men who talk softly, dress conservatively, and behave humbly, unctuous men. President Woodbury is not unctuous. Your persistent image of him is this flamboyant thespian wielding an enormous cape, this showy orator. Your mother, who was in the old Salt Lake 18th Ward by Woodbury 30 years before, recalls that he hired two bands for his Saturday night missionary farewell. Now, you never see President Woodbury wear a cape, and he's often soft-spoken, but his suits are expensive and hand-tailored. His top coats have velvet collars. He's always impeccably groomed. His eyes are glitter as they see everything. There's this constant smile on his large, eager lips. And there's his wife, a perfect match. Indeed, in front of God and everybody in the mission, he calls her Bubbles. You have several telephone conversations with President Woodbury during the late October and early November. In each one, he goes on enthusiastically about this new era. You write in one of your November letters home that President Woodbury has hit the mission like a whirling dynamo, whipping out bulletins and enthusiasm at a tireless pace. But you're very busy that fall. You're conducting branch conferences most every weekend. You're working with district missionaries. You're keeping records and writing reports and letters. You're dealing with your own missionary work. And you're preparing to conduct your first district conference. And your first time organizing any large-scale operation. You do everything from hiring the hall and getting the word out to organizing the meetings. You call the speakers and arrange seating orders and coordinate transportation. And then it's mid-December, and it, by gosh, goes off pretty well. And President Woodbury's the main speaker, of course, and you meet him for the first time face-to-face, and he's frankly awesome. A true original, you know that even then. And you like him, and he seems to like you. And you know in an instant the last months of your mission will be an intense and strange and boisterous ride. The beginning of that ride happens very fast. In early January, you're called to be supervising elder of the South London District. President Woodbury tells you he's phasing missionaries out of local leadership positions all over the mission. You should concentrate on making converts. He also tells you street meetings are a thing of the past. There won't be time. Then he tells you he's calling you to the top spot in the mission, and he's sure you'll accomplish great things. You're flattered, of course, but you suspect he tells everybody pretty much the same thing. But then your life does change, big time. You're called to lead 18 missionaries through the implementation of a new teaching plan. This new plan consists of 7 lessons. The missionaries are to memorize these lessons word for word. Prospective members don't respond promptly and properly, you're to move on. And it works. You're traveling all over the district giving pep talks and demonstrations, and you and your companion yourselves baptize maybe half a dozen people in London in less than 4 months. And it's all very heady and bracing, exhilarating. You write your folks in late March that your district's a runaway leader in missionary hours worked and convert baptisms. And you note you haven't gone to a movie in 2 months and you haven't missed it. So T. Baring Woodbury comes into the mission like a minesweeper. He brings concrete standards. He judges people quickly and accurately. He makes the mission hop, and he makes the missionaries almost insanely goal-oriented. But if you pass his tests, he showers you with praise and makes you feel 8 feet tall, and you still have fond memories of him. This inspiring man who liked you and thought you were capable. You don't quarrel with people who tell you you're terrific, even if you wonder at the standards. But what about all those new converts you and Elder Leroy Matthews from Virgin, Utah are making in London? You don't really remember exactly how many there were. You can't find you even wrote them down. And you have only vague memories of who they are. The final thing President Woodbury does for you before you go home is to call you into his office and advise you what you should do with the rest of your life. Gary, you go back and finish at BYU, then you go to Harvard Business School, get your MBA, and you work as hard as you can and make millions of dollars so you can retire early and serve the church. Subtext, do this, and you're an odds-on favorite to be at least a mission president, maybe even a general authority. You realize that T. Baring Woodbury quite likely has the idea that the church pecking order isn't unlike the mission pecking order. Certainly you ponder his advice, but you return to BYU, and within a week you're auditioning for a play, and you never look back, really. So it's with some interest you pick up the BYU alumni magazine a few years ago and see Merrill Bateman's picture on the cover, the new BYU president. After his mission, he went to Harvard and got his MBA. Then made millions of dollars working for the Mars Candy Company. You do wonder a few moments about the road not taken, but not very long, really. The last time you see President Woodbury is at a British mission reunion a few years later. He greets you warmly, even though you've grown a beard for some role you're playing, maybe Edmund the Bastard in King Lear, you remember thinking he had a sad look about him. You don't know why. You just think that. Now, you know things change in 40 years. You only have to read your father's mission journal to know that. Mississippi, 1925 to 1927, most of it rural Mississippi. He and his companion walk rough dirt roads, knocking on doors, looking as much for a meal and a place to stay as for converts. When they have distances to travel, they'll hitch rides. One, he records, on a rickety old flatbed truck with a dozen Negroes and a load of watermelons. He receives almost no money from home. Often he sells pamphlets and books of Mormon for enough to eat. And he and his companion hold lots of street meetings. They attract people by singing. And your dad admits he cannot carry a tune. One winter in Biloxi, they cadge oysters and clams from friendly fishing boats to survive. A lot different from your mission and almost halfway back to the first British mission. So, of course, lots of things change. And what's been gained since 1927 and 1959 is clear. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is now a true worldwide religion, strong on every continent. And there are temples all over the world, and there are millions of priesthood-holding people of color. But you remember things. You remember those slowly ripening friendships. You remember the complex and strange theological world you felt free to explore with companions and investigators. You remember the high drama of those street meetings. You remember defining your own days. You remember the actual journey of the temple ceremony and those old actors. And you remember being trusted to encounter the world, to absorb the culture you entered for a time. You know you're assuming too much about what current missionaries don't experience and underestimating how profound their experience is. You know you're of an age where lots of things aren't as good as they used to be, where you're feeling parts of your brain turning to concrete. So mostly what you're doing here is just reminding yourself, and what you're really saying is that there's not a week still you're not grateful for your mission. And one of the things you appreciate the most was the sense of discipline it brought you. Now, many of your loved ones think you struck a deal with the devil when you chose to plunge on with your theater studies. Your mother sure thought so. To the day she died, she thought so. And maybe you did. Edmund the Bastard does say, "Thou nature art my goddess." And you had to have known that theater provides you something religion doesn't, maybe an alternative way of understanding and managing the world. William Butler Yeats says in his autobiography, "There is a relation between discipline and the theatrical sense. If we cannot imagine ourselves as different from what we are and try to assume that second self, we cannot impose a discipline upon ourselves, though we may accept one from others." My mission did allow me to accept a discipline from others, but some impulse inside kept pushing me until I could impose one on myself. I became as fascinated by theater as Hamlet. And bear with me on Hamlet as he talks to himself or maybe to 3,000 people in his audience. "Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working all his visage waned?" What's he asking? He's telling us actors, replace yourself, your very soul, with someone else, some other character, some other persona, some other soul, assuming a second self in Yeats' terms. Heavy, scary stuff. But you discover who you are by becoming other people, whether you're writing other people or acting other people or directing other people. Always understanding you are other people and yet you aren't other people. But as you become other people, you yourself become other than you were and therefore more yourself. A great cosmic paradox. And your missions may be the longest you ever had to sustain a role. And there's the great dramatic irony in the last moments of waiting for Godot. And you think about Diana, your wife. Dee Dee says, "Well, shall we go?" Gogo says, "Yes, let's go." Stage direction, they do not move. Through theater, you learn irony, and through irony, you learn that nothing is what it seems, and at the same time, everything is exactly as it seems. And it seems like a pretty good way to spend a life, at least if you're not out in sub-Saharan Africa or the highlands of Haiti helping feed people or cure them of these common but horrible diseases or treat them for AIDS. And you're happy the church is starting to pay attention to such things. In fact, you love the church. It's your heritage. Most branches of your family lived in Nauvoo. Most were in Utah before 1850. Your great-great-grandfather, Samuel Miles, knew Oliver Cowdery before Joseph Smith knew Oliver Cowdery. You love the church because Joseph Smith created it, and you've not found a richer or more potent or more outrageous vision of God than his. You love the church because it taught you values that matter. And you love the church for the 800-pound gorilla it always has been and always will be on your back. And you love your mission. You love it because it gave you the self-confidence to date Mormon royalty, to seek out a mate who'd give you a good run for your money, who understood the irony of it all by the time she was five. A mate who saw through the self-righteous and unctuous iron rod you were to whatever it is you are. It was a good match 40 years ago. It's a damn good match today.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for sharing your lives in these diverse and unique ways. I guess all of us that have been associated with missions know that it's difficult to put your finger on the kind of experiences that we have. Does anyone have any questions? Please feel free to come up and ask questions about missions, the presentations, or other matters of interest. Questioner is wondering what Roger's current status with the church is. Do you feel like answering that?
I talked at Sunset several years ago about some of the evolution. After leaving BYU, I went to law school. I dealt with a lot of issues in my life, including chronic depression and being gay, and part of it involved. Putting some distance between myself and the church. I was telling someone earlier today that until a few years ago, it made me physically ill to come to Utah because I had so much baggage as a feminist and as a gay man. But in the last few years, I've actually been much more comfortable. My parents, my family, two of my three brothers are active in LDS, and my parents are active. My father's in a bishopric. I have in the 10 years. Since I've been away, have most often actually attended Episcopal churches where I've felt most comfortable. But as I suggested in my presentation, I have also increasingly recognized that I will always see the world as Mormon. On the other hand, both because of who I am and because of my attitude and ability to deal with authority, I don't think anytime soon that I will be a conventional Mormon. But certainly, if there are 12 million Mormons, my name is one of the names.
Thanks. Any other questions? I had a question for Roger. Did you feel a sense of holiness in the second mission that you're talking about, in some of the issues that you faced?
I did, and it was interesting being at the ACLU because the ACLU is often accused of being a very secular organization. And although it fights for religious freedom, many of my colleagues come from a very deep suspicion of religion and a feeling like that of all the rights in the Bill of Rights that need work, protecting religion is not something that there are enough people out there doing it. Another one of my colleagues was the son of a rabbi, and he and I felt very. He was glad when I joined them, in our particular office of the other four senior lawyers being very secular and often, without thinking, very hostile to religion. I did feel and do feel a sense of destiny, both in the missions that I've had in my experience, and I've also found that my experience as a gay rights activist has often, surprisingly often, come up involved entangling issues involved the church. The whole California Unite Initiative experience, or Stuart Mattis, who's a young man who killed himself and this year, and whose family are friends of mine, that I do, I have felt that. And I think, as I suggested in my presentation, it's just, there isn't any other way I could experience life except as someone who sees these patterns and has had these experiences and has given up trying to figure out whether I'm seeing the pattern or imposing the pattern. But it is a spiritual experience, even though it's not necessarily the same as other people's.
Thank you. Any other questions? Oh, the questioner is wondering about Roger's insights, possibly into the Knight Initiative, or observations.
4 years ago at Sunstone, I was on a panel that talked about the church's role in campaigning against anti-same-sex initiatives in Hawaii and elsewhere, and it has not changed. That it's the church was the leading organizational force in the campaign in California, which was. In my role in working behind the scenes with the national lesbian and gay community in organizing, I actually am very happy with how things turned out ultimately. I mean, obviously, the election result is disappointing, but it actually was a function of McCain. That once McCain lost steam, the turnout was low, the election itself was a moment in time. But in terms of how it dealt with the community came out much stronger and much less shattered by it than in other like Colorado and Maine that it had fought battles. So it was not as painful experience as one would expect. In particular, many people who supported the initiative, including many leading LDS figures, not necessarily speaking officially, although there was a lot of blurring there, had to take the position that in asking people to vote against marriage, that they would, of course, be against discrimination. And so people who otherwise would be hostile to domestic partner benefits or to anti-discrimination laws were forced to publicly state these things, including a lot of the Mormon people to say that they aren't. And so, I mean, my attitude is to wait and see and say, well, you've won the initiative on marriage. Now let's see the compassion and the end of discrimination that you claimed that you wanted. And I'm actually more hopeful than I expected to be 6 months ago. I'm of course very disappointed, and a lot of my active friends and family have been very disappointed at the church's involvement. And as someone who's been involved in this politics for 8 years and taking a longer view, I think it was very short-sighted. I think that you look at that religious organizations that back, that get that actively involved. It's in the long term. It's you read some of the church's statements about civil rights movement in the 60s and the 70s, and there's a lot of embarrassing things about African Americans that you line them up with some of the statements about lesbian gay people. I am relatively serene because of that sense of history and irony, and I can look forward 20 years very confidently and calmly and say that these will be just as embarrassing then. But I see the glasses half full most of the time.
I had a question for Gary. I'm wondering specifically how your Mormon mission may have affected some of your creative writing. I remember the Great Jell-O Salad Festival.
The Great Jell-O Salad Festival, yeah. Well, my mission and everything I was for 25 years affects everything I do. And I don't know specifically. I think that certainly in my understanding of my mission and the way the church works and the hierarchy fed into the mystery novels I wrote, which were set in Salt Lake, and this kind of pyramid structure I find quite easy to write about and sort of at least mildly satirize. So there's some of that. Well, one of the things, when I arrived in Terre Haute, Indiana in 1975 and became and headed the thing, got a summer theater program to run, which was exciting for 23 years, I brought a lot more disturbing fare through my own experience, and frankly through my own need after a mission and after all of the positive things that Mormonism gave me, I had this desire to do these really depressing, grisly plays. I did a lot of Jacobean plays. My first production I directed in college was The Changeling, and one of the stars was Richard Gere, by the way, and 'Tis Pity She's a Whore, and Danton's Death. I mean, these are all pretty heavy and ultimately kind of depressing plays, but I had to get that side of me sort of filled out. My own plays, I've done them in Terre, done a lot of other places. No one in Utah has ever done one of my plays. The Salt Lake Acting Company read one about 5 years ago that I'd written in the early 80s, and I listened to the reading, and I thought to myself, this really is dated. I don't like this much anymore. I did take one play to the Kennedy Center through the American College Theater Festival, a play called Downwinder Dance. Both my parents are from St. George originally, and everybody down there is related to, not anymore, but used to be related to me. And it has, frankly, one of the dominant ways this disturbed central character expresses herself is through, as we say, language. And it turns out that one of the adjudicators was a BYU prof I'd known years ago. Almost all of them were people I'd known years ago. But he was very moved by the play and recommended it to go on, even though it had maybe, I know somebody told me, 48 or 49 F-words in it. But the piece I'm proudest of now, a play called Mary and Joe, doesn't have that, and it's also least specifically about Mormonism of anything I've written. And I think maybe one reason I'm writing about what I'm writing about now, and I do have a piece on my journey from religion to theater, kind of, and I'm starting to mess with my relationship to Joseph Smith from the time I was three, which I'm probably going to head home and do. But I feel somehow I've got a distance now. It's taken almost 65 years to get there, to maybe write about some of these things.
Do you have any idea what Merrill Bateman may think about?
What?
Do you have any idea what Merrill Bateman may think of your writings? Or has he ever commented, or have you kept in touch?
I prefer the ones without peanuts.
Oh.
It is interesting because after I published my first mystery novel, Homer Durham, who was then a church historian, called the president of my university, who was an old colleague of his in Arizona, and asked how negative to the Mormon church did he feel this book was. And I said, well, what did you tell him, Dick? He said, I thought it was a good story, well plotted. No, I didn't think it was particularly hard on the Mormons. But I do know from other sources that I'm in the computer. And when I wanted to see the inside of the 47 East South Temple, because I was writing this book in which I had to go in there, and it had been a long time since I'd been in there, I got my daughter, who's here today, who just had a new baby, and I went and bought a suit and shaved myself, except for the mustache, and gave my name at the door. I figured, how am I going to get to see these guys? And I thought, well, the best way to get to somebody is to appeal maybe to their egos. So we went over to Deseret Book, and we bought a book by Dallin Oaks and a book... Now I'm dropping names. Who's the old CIA guy? Neil Maxwell, thank you. And they both happened to be in, and they both came out and were very friendly and patted the baby. But Neil Maxwell, because of his CIA background, I guess, started asking me questions about myself. So I became quickly an insurance salesman from Indianapolis who was working on a law degree. But they were very nice, and it was good to be able to see inside their offices. And... maybe I have still too much fun with the church. I don't know. How does the church deal with the arts? Well, the church is very active in the arts. And what was it? 30 years ago, Carolyn, almost, that we had a meeting with Arrington, James Arrington and Trevor Southey and Dennis Smith to sit around and talk about this, the church and the arts. I think I've come to the conclusion that there pretty much has to be a church art that somehow is sanctioned and an art that isn't going to be sanctioned. And I think all of us who claim to be artists probably have to make some kind of decision. And one of my heroines in this whole thing is Carolyn, who has managed to write for the church and to write in a way that people outside the church pay attention. That's remarkable.
Thanks so much. If there are no more questions, we'll adjourn the meeting. There will be tapes of the session for sale outside at the table. Thanks again for coming.